Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettina, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. I'm Dan Rettina, the founder of Dan's Papers, and Dan's Talks guest today is Roger Rosenblatt, who is the author of numerous essays, books, and yesterday, a big half-page letter to the world in the New York Times, which I'm enjoying reading while we're waiting. He is recently best known for a book he wrote called Rules for Aging, and which was a bestseller a year or two ago. And he now has a sequel, More Rules for Aging, that's coming out this month or in early May. And I didn't know there were rules, and now I've got to worry about there being more rules, even besides these.
Anything I can do to burden you, Dan?
What are the newer rules? Have you learned anything from having published earlier rules that are any of them changing?
Well, one thing I learned from publishing the earlier rules, which in fact was 25 years ago, not a few years ago, was you make a great deal of money from the book. So having learned that, I thought, well, I'll write a sequel. And although I'm a slow learner, that's why it took 25 years. But generally, they're the same kinds of rules. When I say nobody's thinking about you, that was a rule of the first book. And I repeat it in a different way in the second. The other rules are run if you hear anyone say we must do this again. They don't mean it. You don't mean it. Nobody means it. That's the kind of rule I give. And there are some serious rules, too.
Well, some of them are don't use common sense. What is that for?
I had a job in the area in which you and I were familiar and you remain, luckily. When I was 16 years old in an inn in Southampton called the Irving Hotel, I got a job as a waiter one morning. And the Irving Hotel, you may remember, was occupied by women who had outlived their husbands, but not yet outlived their money. And so they occupied this very austere and high-class inn. I got my job as a waiter, and the first woman I was assigned to serve at breakfast wanted a plate of prunes. I thought this was an unusual order, but I thought, you know, if that's what she wants, I'll bring her a plate of prunes. She looked at the plate, and she said, "There are too many prunes on this plate." I said, "Don't eat them all."
There you go.
Now, instead of regarding that as practical advice, she regarded it as a wisecrack. Called the head waiter over, and I was demoted to busboy on the spot.
As you well should have been in the beginning. Margot Horn, I remember the name, was the wife of the colonel who ran that.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, she became a crazy realtor for a long time.
Well, that was quite an ambition.
Anyway, here's another one I'm looking at. Don't criticize anyone for anything, ever.
That is so true. We are told that people will appreciate criticism, especially from a friend. If you were to criticize me, or if I were to criticize you, we are told it'll be taken all in good stride. My experience is that nobody wants to hear your criticism, no matter how foolish your ideas are, I'm crazy, or politics, or whatever you're saying, nobody wants to hear it. And as soon as you say it, they will criticize you. So are you happy now?
That's tit for tat. Run when they say we must do this again. You mentioned that one.
I said that before. If somebody says we must do this again, nobody means it.
That's true. And don't.
Don't.
Never read Proust. What is
Proust? Everybody says they read Proust all the time. Actually, Proust is quite wonderful. But because they say it all the time, I suggest don't bother and don't get into a conversation about it.
You're so smart. That's a root.
I forget what that one is. I have the book here, though, if anybody would like to take a look at it.
There's another one called Leave the money and run.
That's from my earlier book, right?
No, I'm looking at your new book.
Oh, I remember. I remember. Because I tell a story from Richard Wright's autobiography about two black young men who were forced into a fight and they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to get into the boxing match, and the white men wanted to goad them into it. And they f offered them $5 a piece, which is a lot of money for these young men. So they fought and they said, well, we can pull punches during the fight. Well, of course, what naturally happened is one threw a punch a little too hard, another threw a punch a little too hard, and at the end they had beaten each other bloody, all for $5. Never do it for the money.
And I'll give you a couple of others to make comment on. Since you have nothing to do when you're old, get someone to help you.
Yes, that's it. That's the whole rule.
Another rule, the 10-minute rule. What is that?
Someone tells you that they want to interrupt you, Mr. Rotino, can I just have your time, 10 minutes of your time? They don't mean it. And
No.
if you are foolish enough to give them 10 minutes of your time, you deserve all the punishment you can get.
Well, now this rule is connected by a string to the New York Times letter you wrote.
It wasn't a letter, Dan. I write essays for the New York Times opinion page.
It says, "Go where you are loved."
Yes, absolutely.
The letter you wrote to the Times that just came out.
Dan, it's not a letter. Every month I write an opinion essay for the New York Times. That yesterday's was the most recent.
Right. You are praising older women.
Yes.
My name,
By name.
Catherine Graham, your own wife.
Rita Dove.
Yeah.
And Arlene Alda.
Yep.
And I know lots of, I have dozens of old, you get old enough, you just know older women. And they are a wonder. They are a wonder. So essays in praise of them.
Join the gang is another one.
I have a group of friends called Meatheads, and we go to bad movies together. Women naturally congregate. Men don't congregate so naturally. So this has turned out to be a good idea. A group of guys, six, seven guys, who have dinner once a month regularly, and then we watch terrible movies together.
The Gloria Loomis rule.
That has to do with money, too. She's been my agent for 50 years, and the idea is love is more important than money. We have been together all that time, 51 years, actually.
No, I saw you on the stage in at Bay Street about 2 or 3 years ago, and you were a stand-up comic.
Kind of. I was sitting down at the piano, but otherwise I was trying to be a comic. Anyway, I was trying to talk about writing and how funny, say, well, not they're not all funny, but some things that have to do with writing. Can I tell you a rule that appeals to me and I think appeals to your sensibility, which is listen for Bob Marley. That's one of the rules here. The doorman in our building is a big guy named Juan. He's 6 foot 5, must weigh 350, 375 pounds. When I walk my dog early in the morning, 4 a.m., because I like to walk the dog at that hour. But it's in the city and it could be dangerous. He always watches out for me, stands in the door, watches me take the dog, bring the dog back. One day I was getting out of the elevator and I heard this beautiful voice singing One Love, Bob Marley's song. And it wasn't Marley's voice, but it was a beautiful voice. There wasn't any accompaniment. I said to Miguel, did you hear that? And he looked shy and turned away and said, yes, it was me. I thought, my goodness, you and I have lived a long time, and still you can be beautifully surprised by the surprises of the world. And in this doorman, this big guy who opens the door and closes the door and is very polite and very sweet, there is a beautiful voice singing somewhere inside him.
We have doormen who are Mets fans, which
Oh, that's a hard thing to be these days.
is that's one of the great puzzles of what is going on these days. Here's a real profound question. When did you decide you wanted to be a writer?
It's a question that is profound in the sense that it goes deep. My grandfather, my mother's father, was an artist in Berlin. When they came over in the big migration in the early 1900s, he couldn't get a job as an artist here in America. So he became a sign painter. And those were the days if you had a store and you needed a sign, you had it painted. We lived in Gramercy Park, and on his way back to the Lower East Side where he lived, he would stop and he would tell me stories. And he'd sit at the end of my bed and tell me stories in the evening. And one night he sat at the end of my bed and he didn't say anything. And I said, "Pata," that was my name for him, "Pata, don't you have a story for me?" And he said, "Raj, why don't you tell me a story? Tonight you tell me a story." "Well, I didn't have it." I said, "I was 4 years old." I said, "I don't have any story." He said, "Well, what did you do today?" And I told him of the day Mrs. Morris in the neighborhood took the neighborhood kids to Palisades Park, and we went on the rides, and then we went swimming in a pond. And I could see that he was interested in the story, so I decided to add a little to the story. So I said that a crocodile came into the pond and started to chase us kids and chased me up a hill. And I went into a cave where there was a polar bear, and the polar bear was having cotton candy. I made up this nonsense as a child would. And I looked at his face and I knew, Dan, for the first time, and you have known this too, when you get somebody's attention, when whatever you write or whatever you say is worthy of somebody's attention. And that's the point where you become an artist one way or the other.
I think it also can be that you want to entertain. That's a
Yes.
way of putting it, I suppose.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, did you write your first bestseller at the age of five?
I stopped writing for a while. I went to school, went to college, graduate school, and got my PhD at Harvard, and then thought I would teach in the university. But the more I saw of university life, the less I liked it. And I was offered a job at the New Republic as literary editor. And I was so grateful to him because that was the beginning of my coming back to where I wanted to be, coming back to that bedside with my grandfather and telling stories again.
One of the most wonderful stories that you've written that I've loved and have reread, I think I even asked you to send me a new copy of it, was when you had your telephone in your new apartment with your roommate, and it turned out to be this one different than a restaurant in
Right.
Manhattan called Lu Chow's.
Right.
Talk a minute about that
Well,
story.
it was not my friend, it was my brother, and my brother got his own phone. And in those days, to have your own phone was a big deal. And his phone number was one digit removed from Lu Chow's famous German restaurant. My father always called it a Nazi hangout. We kept tiring of just telling him wrong number. So then my brother started to take reservations, and so did I. And we started to pretend that we were Lu Chow's, and we asked if they wanted to have blitzes, which we served and enjoyed very much, and in the Deutschland über alles room. And of course, the people at the other end of the phone were a little shocked by this, but they had made the call. It wasn't as if we were doing a prank call, so it was a gift, it was right in your hands. And we did it for a long time, and then we stopped when a woman decided that she wasn't. She called and she said she had to cancel her reservation. And my brother said, "Madam, we can't have people canceling reservations. How can you run a restaurant with people canceling reservations?" And the poor woman was so confused, she almost changed her mind at the time. I said, "Enough already."
I see. That was during a time you were running your essays on the back as the last page of Time magazine,
Yes.
which was a publication that was read at the time widely around the country, as I recall.
Dan, when I wrote an essay, it was read by 31 million people.
Yeah,
It was just an astonishing gift to have that place. Shared it with Lance Morrow. He'd do 1 week and I'd do the other week. Lance died about a year ago. I miss him terribly.
How long did the two of you have that back and forth?
About 12 years.
Was this your favorite too? Was it sound, I'll bet you it got a lot of readers.
It did, and there was a tremendous amount of freedom. And because it was a news magazine, we could go anywhere. If we wanted to write on the news, that was fine. If we wanted to write somewhere else, go in another direction, that was fine too. No, it was a very lucky job.
What are some of the things you're most proud of that you've done as a writer?
I guess, and this is only because I hope it does others good. As you know, our daughter died at the age of 38. She was a doctor, and my wife and I went down to live with our grandchildren for 7 years to help our son-in-law take care of them. And after those years, I wrote a book called Making Toast, which was about that experience. It was a story in The New Yorker, and then it became a book. And the reason that even though it was a painful, the source of it was pain. The reason that I particularly cherish that book is that I've heard from enough people to know who have been in the same kind of circumstance that it did them some good to hear about it. So if writing ever does any good, it's very gratifying.
Thank you for being on the podcast. I wish this particular one would go on, but we have 20 minutes and we're up.
You make it fly by, and thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye.